מרגישים קיץ באוויר. מרגישים קיץ באוויר. כבר 20 שנה.
מרגישים קיץ באוויר.
כל רמה.
כל רמה 102.3 מרגישים קיץ באוויר.
שידור ישיר ממחנה רמה בברקשיירס. אנחנו כל רמה. 102.3 FM.
Shalom and welcome to another very special edition of Parsha Talk. I'm Rabbi Elliot Malamud in Highland Park, New Jersey, at the Highland Park Conservative Temple Congregation on Shemet. And joining me, my good friends, Rabbi Barry Chesler, Salam Shechter Day School of Long Island, Rabbi Jeremy Kalmanovsky, Anshei Chesed in New York City. We are recording this on the eve of and the day of 195. This is day of 195 of the war, 195 of
I think it was 194 today.
Today,
Israel and it became 195.
So we're reaching these incredible numbers. You know, soon it will be 200, and these are unfathomable for us. And this anguish and excruciating pain. Of course, the whole experience is shaping the way we are approaching the holiday of Pesach, and that's what we're going to focus on. With apologies to Parshat Metzora, which has a lot of very interesting. It is an amazing Parsha. It is also Shabbat HaGadol. But in case people want to know the rituals relating to the reacceptance of the person afflicted with scale disease and how that person goes back into the community, please send me an email. I'm happy to send you my Parsha sheet for this week, which We'll discuss some of that. And the renewal, the person comes out as a newborn, basically, shaved, new skin, etc. But we're not going to talk about that. We're going to talk about Passover, because this really is our last Parsha talk before Pesach. We won't be having a Parsha talk until after, or until, well, we'll see. Maybe we'll have one for Shabbos Chol HaMoed, but this is the last one before the Seders. And so Passover has so much for us to discuss. You know, I feel as we start out, I was saying to you before we start recording, you know, wouldn't it be great if the three of us and our families got together for Pesach? It would be Maaseh b'Rabbi Kalmanovsky, b'Rabbi Chesler, Rabbi Malamud, Shayu Yoshvin.
Wait, in B'nai Brak?
In B'nai Brak. That we were all gathered together, let's say, somewhere. And Hayum Saprim Bitziat Mitzrayim Kol Oto Alayla, and we were talking about the Exodus from Egypt all night Ad Shabau, and until their students came, or until someone came and said, "Would you stop it already? Would you stop it
already?" The students came and asked the most important question in every family's Passover.
Exactly. Can we eat already?
When do we eat? Actually, when you think about that. Okay, we're very impressed that they were Misaprim B'Tzias Mitzrayim Kol Oto Halayla. They stayed up all night until it was time to say the morning Shema. Like, do you think that the pshat of that little story is that they didn't eat, or that they ate, they said Birkat HaMazon, they finished the challah, and they just couldn't stop? What do you think the semantics?
Well, it's interesting because the way this story is constructed, it precedes the Bar Kokhba revolt, or is part of the Bar Kokhba revolt. In the Mishnah, almost 100 years later, you already can't eat after the Afikomen.
No, it doesn't say that they didn't eat. Hayumisubin bivnebra.
They were reclining.
Reclining. They were eating.
Right. But I think what the Torah suggests is that, you know, one of the things that we have to reckon with is, as human beings, we tend to think that things always were the way that they are, even though historically there has to be a first thing and a second thing. And I think the story predates some of the fixed customs about when you can eat during the Seder that make their way into the Mishnah, into later Jewish tradition. That, of course, they were eating. They were not staying up all night without eating. Because let's face it, we all like to talk, some of us more than others, I admit, but none of us ever stayed up all night talking without eating anything.
It reminds me of the later Jewish practice of making, there is an all-night holiday of engaging in a kind of ritualized study. It's just not Passover.
Right, so, but it's punctuated by eating. It's not done where you don't eat anything all night.
No, I got it.
Well, you know,
in the Shavuot story, the thing is that there was like an expectation, like it's praised to stay up all night studying Shavuot because the people kind of fell asleep at Sinai and there was thunder and lightning had to wake them up. But that as a practice, it didn't get started until the 16th century. The people actually did it. And it coincides with, as the historian Elliot Horowitz wrote, with the introduction of coffee.
Coffee, okay. Mm-hmm. So let's go back for this because we're in it. So, you know, it's interesting. I started out by saying, wouldn't it be great if we got together? And I wonder, you know, if these rabbis, Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yoshua, Rabbi Elazar, and Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon got together often. Let's imagine for a moment that they're not used to getting together, and that the same way that it would be difficult for us, the three of us, to have a Seder together, it may have been difficult for them to have a Seder together, or for people to get together in around a table in someone's house. They would have to be in the same place, you know, notice that there's no family here, there are no wives and no children, etc. These are the scholars that are simply yakking away all evening. And it's the organization of their lives is master and pupil, it's teacher and student. And so that itself is something fascinating to see. But I want to just go back to the fact that they are together and they all have different views on things. I mean, the three of us have, you know, we don't agree on everything, but we are together. And I think there's a joy in that. And perhaps the most elementary part of this piece that strikes me on reading it is that coming together is what gives us a certain joy. And here again, our theme, one of the themes that we have to think about is, so here we are, and we have a gaping hole in our lives. In the Haggadot that have been coming out, there's a discussion of the brokenness. There's a discussion of, you know, the empty chair. There's a discussion of to what extent, you know, we are incorporating this whole experience, this trauma of the Jewish people, the entire Jewish people that we've experienced since October the 7th. How is that going to fit into our seders? And so, right, if Rabbi Eliezer, Yehoshua, Elazar, and Akiva, and Tarfon are there under trauma, or they're there under a different kind of experience, and what does the situation that they're in, how does that change a conversation? And so, I wonder if you have any reflections on that. Go ahead.
Sure. I'm always good for a reflection or two. I think that one of the things that occurs to me is that this may, in fact, be the first Seder. That, in other words, what is the custom on Yom Tov? The custom on Yom Tov is to sit down for a meal, to say Kiddush, and eat your meal, and then go to sleep. And then what happens here, I think, is that the five rabbis did that, and then afterwards they gather together to tell the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim.
They don't go to sleep. I mean, they're up.
Right, but in other words, they're in the same town, they leave their families at home, and then they meet, you know, presumably in the Beit Midrash or something like that, to discuss Yetziat Mitzrayim. I think the late chancellor of the seminary, Louis Finkelstein, suggested that it was related to the Bar Kokhba revolt. But I think that we could see it as a way of trying to elaborate and fix a tradition that had to change radically after the destruction of the temple. Because now there's no more sacrifice. And even if we say this is 60 years later with the Bar Kokhba revolt, you know, traditions take a long time to work themselves out. And responses to catastrophe also take a while to work themselves out.
So then interesting, then the line to focus on in that paragraph is, and they are talking about the Exodus, V'lo misaprim b'churban ha'bayit. And they're not talking about the destruction of the temple. The destruction of the temple, which would have been in their lifetime. The greatest trauma that would have... I'm assuming that this event is taking place after the destruction. Am I wrong to assume that?
No, but this is, of course that's correct. Because all these people, Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua, maybe as young people, saw the Beit HaMikdash, but...
Rabbi Tarfon as well, no?
Well, Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua, at least according to the story with Yochanan ben Zakkai, are the two people that take him out of the city.
So these are witnesses to the destruction.
I think they're
but Rabbi not Rabbi Akiva.
Yeah, I think they're younger, that's a great question to make that observation that if in Tanaitic period, so we're talking, you know, approximately 50 to 75 years after the destruction of the temple, they're not talking, I mean, they're talking, what are they talking about? They're talking about Mishnayot that re-encode the stuff you were supposed to do down to all kinds of real minutiae about ritual purity and impurity that is not an actual practice in their lives, but their mythic story, their religious story is not... Oh my goodness, we can't do sacrifices. This, okay, well, we'll talk about the sacrifices. That'll be okay. Their mythic story is Yetziat Mitzrayim. And that's a much like deeper, all in all, a kind of deeper vector in rabbinic Judaism.
It's a deeper vector, but it's more accessible as a story because if they're still close to the destruction, they haven't worked out the narrative of the destruction. Maybe, I mean, they have the Book of Lamentations from the destruction of the first temple. They have Jeremiah and they have that, but they're also, and here again, I don't want to focus, you know, super impose so much, but why not? Okay. So they also have an obligation to have a holiday. It is Pesach. They are in the land. There is a look, we have to do this. We have to commemorate. We're rebuilding something. And so again, the mixture of emotions here is very powerful. I think in some ways they're trying to access the primary story, and then they're figuring out their own personal stories within the primary story. That's what that means. They're talking about the Exodus, which means they're putting their own story into the Exodus.
I think what they're also doing is, so why are they telling the story of the Exodus? It's not just because it's Pesach. They're making a claim that is intended to give comfort and consolation, because the recitation of the story of the Exodus means that even after everything that has happened, meaning the destruction of the temple, the destruction of Jerusalem, redemption still takes place. Redemption is still part of our religious narrative, yeah. And we access it by telling this story.
Okay.
Great observation. By the way, I just kind of add that I've been looking here, as we've been talking about, several of the commentators, of Ravenel in particular, answers this question that I pose. All of this is after the eating, because the early part of the Seder is, you know, involved in the actual consumption of the symbolic foods, Pesach, Matzah, Maror, not the Pesach, but, and so the great praise alights on these guys who went so far above and beyond.
All right, so here I'm going to play Rabbi and do give you the sermon trigger, the sermon spark here, okay? Where's the hope in this, okay? Let's say they're talking about the deep past, and let's say they are projecting their own experiences onto the deep past because what they have witnessed, the trauma of the destruction is so deep. And then all of a sudden, enter the students. Here's my sermon, okay? They're dwelling with it. They're involved in this story all night. Ad shebaot tamidehem, and their students come.
So this is the day after.
Wait. The students say, cut it out. We have to daven, okay? This is the hope. The hope is there's another generation coming. You have an obligation. Stop it. Stop wallowing. Stop telling the story of the past. We are the present now. You need to help us. This is a generational moment here. This is a moment. The liminal divide here in of generations is the teachers and the students. The students are saying to the teachers, "Enough, enough yakking away. We gotta move on."
I think this is why Finkelstein liked that interpretation, which is obviously, you know,
validate.
It must be on the poetic level. I don't really think it's true on a historical level that there's some sort of reference to the Bar Kokhba revolt here. You know, Rabbi Akiva's, you know, support of Bar Kokhba is I think suggestive, but not more than that. But what is, I think, on a literary or poetic level, very appealing about this passage is, you know, the dawn is happening, and that aligns you. I'm not sold just yet on, you know, for us, a generation gap and a generational divide is an extremely present thing. We all know the major differences between, you know, one generation to another, and the 1920s and the 1960s and the blah, 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 and the kids and the millennials and the Gen Zers. And I don't really think that ancient people would have had that same consciousness. Maybe they did. But that idea that now the dawn is rising is like tremendous. It sounds like a tremendously affirmative way of saying that is the story here. You had a Leil Shimurim. You had this last night where you're listening to the cries of the dying Egyptians. You had this meal, which some people think they actually ate. And then the dawn comes and you leave imprisonment. Like, that's just amazing. And the students come and say, Higiyazman Kriyash Mashal Shacharit. It means it's time to look out at a world in which Hashem Echad is like evident.
I'm going to use that line. That's a great line. And I think people watching and listening should use the line because if you're saying, if you're asking a question, which is, how can the Seder give me hope? And where would you find Seder? And how would you construct a narrative within the whole Haggadah to find hope? I would say this moment is a moment of hope when the students say the dawn has come. So, and now teachers look at the dawn. Go ahead.
So the question is, they don't say it's time to daven. They say it's time to recite the Shema. And the question is, do we see their statement as being prose or poetry? I think it's prose, because I imagine the five rabbis on the mountaintop, and they have to come down off the mountain, because you can't live on top of the mountain. You could go there occasionally, but life is the nitty-gritty in the day-to-day grind. And that's where you have to make hope happen.
So are you saying they're making a halachic statement?
I think they're reminding the rabbis that you've elevated yourselves and us spiritually, but we need to come back to earth. And the question I think I would ask is, where are the students coming from?
Yeah.
Are they with the rabbis, or are they somewhere else?
So where do you think?
I don't know, but I wanted to connect it with the next little passage, which I also love.
Go ahead.
About the Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, who didn't understand that we had to say the Shema, the third paragraph of the Shema at night, until Ben Zoma expounded. And this is, if I remember this correctly, is based on a passage in the Tosefta as well. It appears in the Mishnah, but it's also one of the questions raised in the Tosefta is whether Pesach is going to be observed in Yemot HaMashiach.
Yeah.
And it's been a long time since I looked at it, but I think that the one opinion is that it will be said, that you have to always mention the Exodus from Egypt. There will never be a time when that redemption can go unmentioned. And there's hope in that too. You know, it was Sadia Gaon, we mentioned him earlier, I think, or maybe before the show, said that because of this redemption, we're assured that there will be a final redemption.
So,
you know, once something happens, it can happen again. It's much harder to imagine something that never happened than something to happen twice.
So on the theme then of finding hope in the Haggadah, you would locate hope not necessarily only in the generational moment, the dawn, which are like, but also in the hope of an eternity, or hope of an era of redemption, in which even the story is told in that era. Is that what you're saying?
Something like that. I think we aspire to redemption, and we fall short in our lives on this earth. Again, as I mentioned more than once, I'm always struck by that image of Moses alone atop the mountain at the end of his life, with his glimpse of the promised land, never to get into it. And I find that an incredibly powerful image, because Moses, we're just like Moses. We don't make it into the promised land. We don't merit the final redemption in our lives, but we have hope, faith that when we awaken, we will be in the promised land.
This is so, so resonant, with like the DNA of the spiritual person. You just expressed it perfectly. In our own individual lives, we will always be an unredeemed world. And we spend every day in the famous phrase, as interpreted by Ishaya Leibovich, we must always have faith in the Mashiach, that he will arrive in the future. You know you're in trouble when you think the Mashiach has already arrived, and we know that with certain of our Brooklyn compatriots and some of the most, in my humble opinion, most destructive of the radical nationalist extremists in Israel. They think the Mashiach is already here. They think that the given state of affairs is like the totally realized perfection, and it's not. But an American can't hear that phrase you just said so beautifully, Barry, without thinking of MLK. I've been to the mountaintop. I may not get there with you, but the day is coming when you say, free at last, free at last. And so I just think that a religious person does have the sense that redeemed world is gestating in this unredeemed world.
Okay, so let's change gears here. Say, I want to ask the question of, the holiday is a joyous holiday, and yet there's tremendous pain. And we should give vent to the pain, but we shouldn't forget the joy. And so in some ways that makes it very, very quintessentially Jewish and in a very deep sense. But, approaching certain, key moments in the Haggadah, like, for example, Dayenu. Dayenu was very hard to sing this year. It would have been enough for us. And I mean, a few versions have come out that have tried to construct this song with this present reality. And there are other, very popular, renditions of Dayenu focusing on modern Jewish history, etc. But the whole notion of Dayenu, it would have been enough for us, already makes us ask a question. Now, we did a little bit of digging prior to recording and tried to do the historical critical research of when Dayenu was composed. We don't have a definitive answer, but it starts appearing in Haggadot around the time of Sa'adia Gaon. Sa'adia Gaon, give me his dates, probably 9th, 10th century, very important.
882 to 942, I think.
Yeah, very important. Impressive. Very important figure. The last of the great Babylonian, sages.
He was the last one at his yeshiva. I can't remember. I get it. Yeah.
Important figure in both the history of halakha, the history of liturgy, interpretation, etc., and wrote a very important translation of the Bible in Arabic. But the poem probably precedes him. Some scholars go back all the way to Talmudic times, maybe even before. That's not where we want to go. It's a great lecture, but the word Dayenu means it would have been enough for us. It starts, Ilu hotzianu mimitzrayim v'lo asavem shvatim Dayenu. Had he brought us out from Egypt and not inflicted judgment on the Egyptians, it would have been enough. Just to be brought out would have been enough. And the question really is, really, it would have been enough.
No, I finally got it while I was listening to you describe this, Elliot, is that the Dayenu only makes sense from the end. In other words, if only the Exodus had taken place, no one would have said Dayenu.
Okay.
They wouldn't have made up 15 passages from Egypt to, I guess, the Red Sea. It's only when we could look back that we have to remember that redemption is a process, that we should be grateful for every step, even though we all know we're not grateful until we get to the final step.
So in some ways, we're just by saying Dayenu, we're saying the chorus. There must be a musical term for this, because there are enough popular songs where the chorus doesn't make sense until you read the whole song, like My Girl Bill.
I mean, in a sense, that thing we were just talking about the unfulfilled quality of redemption is the opposite of Dayenu, because like the straight up shot, the semantic meaning of Dayenu, which, as we kind of joked about, is as you just said a minute ago, and as we joked about before, it's not really true, right? If you took us into the desert but didn't feed us with manna, Dayenu, okay, Dayenu in the sense that you should feel gratitude for each step along the way, but it would have been pointless. If you had brought us into the Red Sea but not let us pass through on dry land, then instead of Dayenu, we would have said, glug, glug. So the gratitude part you're supposed to get, but the unfulfilled quality of redemption, that's the painful part that you have to hold. So I called up one of the hostage moms, Shelly Shemtov. Her son is named Omer. And whether he's still in the land of the living, we don't know. But she puts out in Israeli media, people, our listeners and loyal fan club will probably know that in Exodus 4, right, there's the four lishonot of Geula, the four expressions. Vehotzeti etchem, vehitzalti etchem, vegaalti etchem, velakachti etchem. I will bring you out of Egypt, and I will rescue you from their burdens, and I will redeem you, velakachti etchem li la'am, and I will take you to be my people. And then there's a fifth, and those are the associated with the four cups of wine. And then there's this fifth promise, veheveti, and I will bring you to the land that I swore to your ancestors. And so she writes out here, this year, she said, the kos hamishi, lichvod hachatufim v'chatufot, the fifth cup, and many people have the fifth cup. The fifth cup is our Elijah cup anyway. In the Middle Ages, many of the halachic authorities said you should drink the fifth cup anyway, and that was certainly before they ever had large settlement in the land of Israel. She writes, in honor of all of the hostages, b'de'aga, in fear, be'ahava, in love, u'be'achrayut, and in responsibility, hakol, kol ha'misubim, kamim ve'umrim, all the people who are surrounded at the table should stand up and say, may it be your will that that among every male and female hostages, all five expressions of redemption, including v'heveti, I'll bring you home, will be fulfilled. V'yizku kulam lashuv, and may they all be privileged to return l'chek mishpachotehem, to the loving bosom of their families, bri'im ushlemim, healthy and in one piece. Yeah,
Where is that site?
I will put it in the chat here in a second. V'nizkech kulanu l'kabel et pneihem, may we be privileged to greet their faces, b'simcha, she'en l'mala mimena, just the absolute ultimate simcha, b'mher av yameinu, amen. And I will, for my friends here, put this in the chat.
We'll let you just speak out the words, the website, so that we can...
It's yeshuvnet, no, I'm sorry, yeshuvnik.net, and then a bunch of letters and numbers. So, but if you put up Shelly Shemtov and her son Omer, that perhaps will get you there.
So as you say this, I'm you know, there's the practical aspect of this, that people do want these kinds of resources. And I do have this painful question, which is, you know, we build up and build up and build up, and the reality is so crushing, and we may one day be in a reality with real despair here, after all this build up. And in some ways we do have to undulate between this. The contemporary Seder does have this moment, the very complicated emotional moment after the meal, Eliyahu HaNavi. Maybe that's a moment. I keep thinking, you know, what are the key moments of the Seder in which we can do this, in which we can, you know, speak to the situation, then move into, you know, Yetziat Mitzrayim, sing a little bit, think a little bit, talk a little bit, eat a little bit, and then go back to this reality, and then, you know, have the joy of the Seder. I mean, the Seder will undulate through these different emotional peaks and valleys, and it already does. I mean, I think the beginning of the Seder, it's a joyous moment, but a sad moment also, because, you know, families around their table don't see people that are people are there are people missing from our families just through the course of life. You know, we live long enough to love many people, and they reach the upstairs Seder. They have their Seder, the heavenly Seder. And that's sad. And then Eliyahu HaNavi is sad. And Bechol Dor V'Dor in some ways sad. And Ban Nitzach is sad. That we scream out to God, and the sense that Ban Nitzach El Adonai Eloheinu El Avoteinu Vayishma Adonai Koleinu. We cry and God listened. And so I sometimes say, you know, we're in that suspension between the crying to God and the listening. And we have to live there. It's very hard. And so, you know, we have to kind of give voice to this. And perhaps precisely at the moment, I think, Jeremy, that fifth cup, that's where you would say it, perhaps, right? Normally you would do a fifth cup even then, I guess. Right?
So I guess one way to say this is the you want that Seder to cultivate in the participants both of the dynamics, of feeling like you have left Egypt. Because if you don't feel that this religion is equipping you to have experiences of joy, celebration, and affirmation that even though the world sometimes is very unfair or there's lots of misery, that in the end of the day, you know, there's a redemptive heart. You got to have that, otherwise you can't make it until tomorrow. But you also want it to cultivate in you that sense of the unredeemed world. So we need them. We need them both, really.
True. All right.
That's why you got to eat matzah, and you got to eat maror,
and you got to eat charoset, and you got to raise a glass, and you got to tell stories, and you have to.
And you have to conclude, as we do, l'shana haba'a b'Yerushalayim habanuya.
Indeed,
man. In some respects, I'm thinking, how are we going to have Pesach? In some respects, I'm thinking, how can we not have Pesach? There, that's the website. That's
so. I'm putting it up on the share for people. It's Yeshuvnik, YeshuvNik.net numbers. And here, I'll make it just bigger here. Arba kosot shetiknu chachamim, etc., etc. People will have to watch this on slow motion. Yehi ratzon shitkaimu b'chol chatufa u'b'chol chatuf, etc., etc., etc.
There's a little. If you go down a little more, there's a kind of a graphic. She or
yeah,
somebody.
Yeah, nice. Yes. All right. Well, good resource, and I'm gonna print this up and translate it for my people. Well, you know, we've come to the end of our mini Seder here. Of course, we're wishing all of our friends and families and our loyal watchers, viewers, listeners, wish you a beautiful Seder. I want to say, this is a great little Seder. It's a little Seder. This is, we have just reenacted here for everyone what a conversation, what a Seder conversation should be or could be.
Can I please have? I know we're in Malamud's house here, so yeah. It's a vegan Seder. vegan Seder, but if we're going to, at my house, maybe we can have a little chicken soup, maybe a little bit.
So you know what I'm going to try making this year? I'm going to try and make a vegan brisket, which is shredded trumpet oyster mushrooms with tofu. I eat kitniot. And it's got a whole mess of spices and whatever thing in it. And you just bake it and
we'll once, see what once happens. Once you go vegan vegetarian, you got to eat kitniot. It's just...
I'm past that already.
No, me too. I mean, when my kids started going veggie, then we moved over. And that sounds lovely, all that stuff. All right.
We're praying for the hostages. We're praying for Klal Yisrael. We pray for everyone that we should have a sweet, beautiful... and joyous Pesach. And on behalf of the three of us, we look forward to seeing you again. A beautiful person.
Chag Sameach.
Shabbat Shalom. Chag Sameach.